Good evening, listeners, and welcome to part 6 of The Vanishing Season, a Gothic Victorian novella by Katie Darby, read by Katie Darby. This story so far, it's summer, 1892. James Emerson, a Cambridge historian, has gone to see his old friend Chester Whittingstall, who recently discovered a medieval doom painting at the church where he is vicar, St. Peter's, Weniston, in Suffolk. Arriving, Emerson finds Chester gone, so he views the painting alone, attempting to sketch some of the devilish figures, and falls into a sort of trance, missing his train. Forced to stay overnight, he thinks he sees a feral, hunched figure sitting atop a new-dug grave from his window overlooking the graveyard. Next morning, he dismisses it as a dream, but then sees a naked footprint in the fresh soil. Thinking Chester may have fled to the village of Hartis to discover the identity of the doom artist, he decides to follow, hiring a horse and gig. But it seems that something preternaturally swift is also following him, and a breathless chase ends in his crashing his vehicle. 20 minutes later, greatly dishevelled and chastened, we trotted slowly into the yard of the King James, Stowmarket, where my horse was led by a startled stable boy to a place of oats and hay, and I limped into the public bar with brandy on my mind. I must have presented quite a sight after my tumble, for the fellow behind the bar hesitated a moment before addressing me as sir, but my money was good enough, and it got me what I wanted. It was only halfway down the first glass of a surprisingly good cognac that, recalling the leap of the deer into the road, I realised it had emerged from the wrong side of the forest entirely. The deer had come from the left. Yet all the rustling and chasing, the unseen pursuer we had tried to outrun, had been upon our right. How had I not seen it at the time? My logical faculties seemed to have shrivelled and seized up, along with my courage. I shuddered and drained my brandy, craving the false fire of alcohol even in this stifling heat. I still did not know what had been keeping pace with us, but I had some very unpleasant suspicions. I pushed my empty glass forward again and tapped its side. "Another," I said hoarsely. After my third brandy, and a prodigious steak and kidney pie which would have put hairs on the chest of the mildest boy soprano in the King's College Choir, I felt considerably better. Not precisely myself again, but a bolder, cruder version of myself, for which I blamed taking spirits so early in the day. Never a practised imbiber, I could hardly recall the last time I had drunk before dinner. And if I am honest, it did something to my head that I rather liked. Refreshed and restored, at least internally, I decided it was high time I made repairs to my outward appearance. This had, I sensed, been the subject of muttered commentary from fellow patrons, even though I had kept myself in the darkest corner of the bar, and I supposed I ought to inspect the damage. The inn was one of those well-furnished modern places, and the bathroom did not disappoint. Wherever was not gleaming tile was polished wood, and I was even fortunate enough to find a full-length mirror before which to admire my looks. However, I confess that when I first turned to face it, I hardly knew myself. No wonder the market-day farmers had frowned and muttered. No wonder even the rough-hewn stable lad had visibly blanched. My face was badly scratched, and where brambles and twigs had not left their bloody traces, dark stubble showed through, despite my careful shave of this morning. That would have been disreputable enough, but my filthy shirt, which I only now realised was also torn in several places, and wild, wind-whipped hair completed the look of a desperate villain who had been dragged sideways through a hedgerow. I leaned forward, examining myself in astonishment. From the respectable, linen-suited scholar of yesterday to the double-dyed felon who now challenged my stare was a long fall. Yet my tumble had taken a matter of seconds, and this was the frightening result. "Dear me," thought I, peering closer, "I have half a beard already. I can hardly present myself to the Vicar of All Saints in this condition." Moreover, I was covered head to toe in road dust, which my own sweat had turned to brown stains about my collar, armpits, and chest. Nor were my trousers spared. Dead leaves from the ditch clung to them, and as I bent over to pluck off my bosky plumage, I heard an ominous rip. The back of my much-abused shirt had split open. Very well. I had yesterday's shirt and the valise at my feet, and soap and water were in plentiful supply. All I had to do was wash and change my linen, and I would attain some half measure of decency again. I filled the little basin and tried to splash my face with the water, but there was not enough to make a difference, and scrubbing the stubbled skin with my hands merely smeared the blood and dirt around. Exasperated, I gripped the sink so hard my fingers whitened, consumed by a sudden mad urge to wrench it off the wall. This intemperate passion was utterly out of character, and again I regretted the brandies I had sunk before lining my stomach with the pie. They had warmed my blood and my temper both, it seemed, and I was in danger of acting like the scoundrel I now resembled. Notwithstanding, the fact remained that I needed to wash myself properly, and this paltry porcelain bird bath was worse than useless. Through the pebble glass of the little window drifted a faint clink of hooves on cobbles, and I realised the yard of the inn must lie just outside. I picked up my valise and quitted the bathroom, finding a door immediately to my left which led out into the bright glare of the sun-bathed courtyard. Shielding my bedazzled eyes, I spotted what I wanted and loped over to a welcome tranche of shade in which water glimmered. I had intended only to immerse my face, but the blessed coolness was irresistible. Before I quite knew it, I had pushed my whole head into the horse trough, kept it under as long as I could, then flung it back, lashing my spine with a splatter of icy drops from my drenched hair. The clear, cold water flirted and spat diamonds in the sunlight as I reared my head, gasping. How beautiful it was! How simple! Why did not everyone do this on baking summer days? I thought of the fountain in the front court of King's and how old Henry VI would frown down upon me were I to indulge this impulse at college, and giddy, helpless laughter bubbled in my throat, which I was powerless to suppress. I was fortunate in that, for the moment, the stables were deserted save for their four-footed denizens. No appalled groom or round-eyed stable lad was witness to my hilarity. Nonetheless, it was prudent to perform my ablutions as swiftly as possible if I did not wish to be discovered and taken for a madman. Accordingly, I began to undo my wrecked shirt. But the buttonholes seemed smaller than I remembered, and my brandy-numbed fingers to have turned all to thumbs. I could smell my own stale sweat, rank as a tannery, and it overwhelmed me. I hardly understood how I had escaped greater censure in the close atmosphere of the bar, reeking as I did. Grunting and cursing, at last I tore the damned garment open in sheer frustration. It was too badly ripped to save, in any case, and my need was urgent. Buttons tittered against the cobbles, and a white-muzzled roan looked up in mild interest as I soaked the shirt rags in the trough and wiped smeary filth from my chest and shoulders with this makeshift washcloth. Every cleansing stroke was the sheerest pleasure. I felt the oppression of the last few days lift from me like steam as I stood half-naked in that hay-scented shadow. Yet there was also something dangerously sensual in this moment of innocent delight, as if my body were an animal I had not yet entirely broken to my control, a horse that might buck, or a hound that might turn out of nowhere and savage me. A door slammed. At once I recalled myself and, whisking up my valise, darted into the nearest empty stall and pulled on yesterday's chemise with a speed I should never have given myself credit for. Tucking in my shirt tails and fumbling close the buttons, I decided that I must do. I pushed back my wet hair into some semblance of a slicked-down style and strode out into the sunlight with considerably more assurance than I felt. The groom, who had just entered the courtyard, was attending to a horse. My own, as it happened, and barely noticed my presence until I approached and asked whether the creature would be ready in an hour. He shrugged and said he supposed so, and from the incurious indifference in his eyes, I judged that I had succeeded in re-entering the realms of the plausibly civilized. I thanked him and returned to the bathroom, where I spent several minutes in the tiled half-darkness, futilely attempting to curb the excesses of my incipient beard with a travelling razor. Alas, my hand was too unsteady and my blade too blunt, or the new whiskers too tough, it mattered not which, for me to make much of an improvement on that score. But at least now I was clean, and the cuts and scratches on my face looked a good deal better already. Back in the public bar, I decided that I must have coffee at once. The inn, I reasoned, was half a hotel, and if they let rooms and offered meals at all hours, they should be able to rustle me up a pot. I needed some stimulant, but any more brandy in this heat and at this hour was out of the question. It was imperative that I thought clearly and calmly about my next steps when I reached Hartest. I devoutly did not wish to make some blunder which would prejudice an overcautious churchman against confiding in me Chester's whereabouts. The landlord, I was gratified to see, had to look twice before recognising me as the, now, gentleman from the corner table, and I made my order, sweetening the request with a decent tip. As I waited, I realised that I ought to reaffirm my route and distance by means of a map, and, suiting the action to the thought, gently caught the arm of the barmaid as she swept past. The effect on her was the very mirror of that on Mrs. Tydell this morning, except that she seemed rather to enjoy my touch than otherwise, and certainly did not object to being accosted. She was a fetching girl, with a long, well-turned neck, thick brown hair that promised the softness of a cashmere blanket, and blue eyes dark as a well. "How can I help you, sir?" she asked, smiling. More accustomed to perfunctory obedience than eagerness to oblige from waitresses and tap girls, I never mastered the skill of charming the servant class, more was the pity. My purpose in stopping her dropped clear out of my head. Apologies. I stalled, faltered, recovered. I should like to see a map, please. I suppose you have such a thing somewhere. Her pretty brow creased. Of the entire county, sir? Oh, indeed, yes. I have some coffee ordered. Perhaps you would be kind enough to bring both over together? I retired to my table beside the empty hearth, removed my folded jacket from the valise, and pulled from its pocket Chester's letter, rather crumpled and creased now from its many consultations. I had fallen into a habit already of turning to this document like some secular bibliomancer whenever I felt at a loss and craved guidance. It was, after all, the last letter Chester had written, possibly the last communication of any sort he had made to anyone. As with any final words, whether their author's departure is long expected or unforeseen, they had gained a supernormal gravity and significance, and I found myself combing over apparently trivial sentences as though they were fragments of some Gnostic text, worrying at them for hidden meaning. At this point, my coffee arrived, complete with cream, sugar, and a well-fingered folding map of the county of Suffolk. I thanked the barmaid with a sixpence, and before she could tuck it away, asked her a supplementary question. "Tell me," I said, "have you by any chance seen a fellow of my type, only shorter and broader and with curly hair, passing through here 2 or 3 days ago?" She glanced around at the bustling room and smiled a little, pity playing over her face. "I know," I said. "The chance is a small one and the haystack large. But it would have been on Wednesday or Thursday." Still she shook her head doubtfully, and the fairy wisps of hair curling about her bare neck stirred, as in a soft breeze. I tore my eyes away. Whence in heaven's name came this distractibility? The cognac here had much for which to answer. "Those must be quieter days," I urged, slipping another sixpence across the table. "And surely you cannot have too many Cambridge chaps dropping by." Something shifted in her evening blue eyes, and she became businesslike on a sudden. "About your age, was he, sir?" She was taking down particulars now. I nodded. "A few years older, but yes, my age, thereabouts." "And dressed discreetly," her gaze skimmed my makeshift ensemble. I had now donned my jacket, but the twice-used shirt was still distinctly worse for wear. "Like a gentleman?" "Yes, exactly." Eagerness surged within me, breaking cover like a startled hare. "No," she said bluntly, "I ain't seen him. But I can ask up at the bar." She tossed her head, indicating the landlord and his lady, both of whom looked the beady-eyed sort. "Good girl," I told her, and directed my attention to the inn's much-used and somewhat out-of-date map. Tracing my route, it seemed I had already come the best part of the distance between Weniston and Hartest, and had less than 20 miles before me. I knew the small village of Hartest from visiting it perhaps 2 years back, in search of some especially charming brasses, which had been recommended to me by my father, who, it seemed, had spent much of his honeymoon making rubbings of them, greatly to my mother's annoyance. It was a pleasant and unremarkable enough little place, with a single peculiarity. A great boulder, called the Hartest Stone, sat at the margin of the village green, and if my memory did not deceive me, there was some faintly scandalous local legend associated with it. Of course, this was of no moment when the real object of interest, of Whittingstall's interest that was, must be the records kept there, which might provide evidence of the Doom's origin. I could well imagine him even now pursuing his historical quarry down the halls of the years, through dusty ledgers and lichened gravestones. I calculated that if I set off smartly, I should arrive in time for the evening service, and could seek an informal audience with the vicar afterwards. He would surely be able to confirm whether and when Chester had visited, and if not... Here, I confess, my improvised plan withered on the vine. For if Whittingstall had not returned to Hartest, I had nowhere else to follow him. His trail, cool enough already after several days' absence, would be quite dead and cold, and my hopes of finding him likewise. Shaking the gnawing thought from me like a rat, I poured a large cup of black coffee and plunged back into contemplation of Whittingstall's letter. Surely, if the innkeeper proved unable to tell me where he had gone, this still might. For I could not quash the notion that there was in these pages some clear path for me to follow, laid out between my friend's casual, eager lines. It only fell to me to read the thing in the right light, with the right eyes, rather like the Doom itself, and I should see everything plain. I tasted the coffee, scalding hot and bitter as sin. They brewed it stronger in Suffolk than in the King's College kitchens. I was not normally a great lover of sugar, but I ladled it in until my cup was sweeter than treacle, and then sipped at the stuff, delicately as a bee drawing nectar from a bloom, while I thumbed through Chester's pages. Here again were the usual greetings, inquiries after my health, regrets that it had been so long, a brief litany of politenesses whose very perfunctoriness revealed the profound excitement which was his real reason for writing. Then there came the great news, bursting out in a barely punctuated rush atop the second page, as if too long contained, followed by a more measured description of the circumstances attending the Doom's discovery. The restoration work, the boards left out in the rain, the morning circuit on which Whittingstall was confronted by the extraordinary vision, and so forth. I rubbed my temples, feeling the scratch of whiskers encroaching again on my cheekbones. A beard seemed to be growing in faster than ever, or perhaps in the strangling heat it only irritated me more. Again, I read over Chester's account of the painting, or of the salient parts of it, and found that far from lingering on the hellish aspects, as I had recalled, as indeed I had done myself, he divided his close attention between three major parts of the composition. The first was the Houses of Heaven, which were clearly the portrait of some place he knew, as I had anyway suspected, and Chester's Suffolk origins had borne out. The second area of interest was the entrance to hell with the hairy, woodwose-like devils, which seemed to have fascinated him almost as much as me. But the third, which I had not especially marked before, was a detailed description of the upper right-hand quadrant in which Mary the Virgin and John the Baptist knelt praying before what I had taken to be Christ's cavern tomb before the rock was rolled away. Chester spent some little time expounding upon the significance of this. He discoursed, not to say digressed, upon the symbolism of burial and rebirth, the triple-layered thematic echo of Hell's Mouth, Stone Tomb, and the earthly graves from which the dead rose all about, until I felt exactly as if I were reading a learned article upon the subject, but not a step closer to understanding what, if anything, he meant to tell me by it. My poor, question-stuffed skull was beginning to smart again, just as it had in the churchyard where I had seen the footprint in the soil. What imaginary clues, after all, was I following? And moreover, what was following me? I poured a second cup of coffee, heaped more sugar into it, and tried to concentrate my mind. For now, I began, I'm afraid, to doubt my impetuous quest, or rather, doubt the assumptions which had led me thus far. I knew my friend to have had his March Hare moments, but really, could he have abandoned his admittedly few and indifferent parishioners on a wild goose chase to discover the artist behind an ancient and quite forgotten painting? Could he have left in such furious haste that he forgot he had invited me to come and see it? Forgot even, upon quitting St. Peter's, to leave a note for the dutiful Mrs. Tydell, or for faithful Oxborough? I pondered. I cast back to Chester at Cambridge, the avaricious miser's gleam in his eye when he had discovered a scrap of scholarly lore he thought nobody else knew, or spoke in a furtive hush of some rare tome only he had examined. He was a generous-spirited fellow in all ways but this. The hoarding of secrets and titillating others with them was his only vice. And on a sudden it came to me. The day he left, he had told nobody where he was going, not because he forgot to in an abstracted intellectual trance, but because he had not wished to spoil the surprise. I stared ahead, unseeing. Yes, it was possible. More than that, probable. I had always supposed my friend had taken on the obscure rural living at Weniston in order to bury himself still deeper in his books, for his considerable gifts would find little appreciation among such a sparse and sleepy congregation. Yet perhaps this new and momentous find had inspired him to turn author at last, kindling a desire not only to write the story of the doom's unearthing, but to discover and tell the whole of its history, too. It is truly a marvellous thing, one of the best I have ever seen. He must have thought he would return too soon to be missed. It was the only thing that made sense. He had set off in the morning for Hartis, knowing it to be a journey of but half a day, to try if his hunch about the artist was correct, and had planned on coming back in time for supper, or at least by nightfall. But in the meantime, something had detained him, whether by his will or against it. I thought again, with a shudder, of the creature I had seen in the churchyard last night. Had it pursued Chester, as I was more and more convinced, it had done me, chasing alongside my gig through that green nightmare of a tunnel. Had it overtaken him even before he could reach his goal? And if it had, what had it done with my friend? And why, and above all, how? I prided myself on being a rational man, and Whittingstall was the same. I could accept that a rare animal existed stranger than any I had seen. Did not platypuses and narwhals and poisonous dragon lizards roam the globe? Yet I refuse to believe that this human-shaped creature with the hide and eyes of a beast had somehow stepped out of a painting, the discovery of which had caused my friend to vanish, it seemed, into the very air. Yet the facts remained. The creature was real. The footmark proved it. And Chester was gone. "Excuse me, sir." The barmaid appeared at my side, all bustle and pother. I wrenched myself from my brown study and looked up to meet her apologetic expression. "I've asked master and mistress both, and nobody's seen no one like your friend, sir." "Oh," I forged a smile. "Well, it is no matter." Poor child looked almost comically stricken. "Is he a close friend of yours, sir?" I pondered this. We had once been bosom pals indeed, calling upon one another daily, knocking one another up late at night and before breakfast, brothers in all but name, sharing an intimacy I have seldom enjoyed before or since. But that was before our misunderstanding. And Chester's sudden departure to entomb himself in Weniston. "Yes," I said. "I miss him greatly." It had been a profound surprise to me to hear from him again, and in such a fashion after so long, and I had nurtured hopes that we might rekindle our friendship over his wonderful find. Yet all the doom had brought either of us so far, it seemed, was misery and mystery. And I was not at the end of this strange road yet. She seemed to sense my dejection, and laid a tentative hand upon my wrist before snatching it back as though burned, doubtless abashed at her own boldness. "I'm awful sorry, sir." I nodded, hollow. "Well, I expect I shall catch up with him eventually." She tried to look as if she believed it. I expect so, sir." She shrugged. "'Tis the vanishing season, after all, and many of them do come back." I stared at her. I beg your pardon?" She halted in the act of withdrawing and turned about, her flower-fresh face a picture of puzzlement. "'Tis the vanishing season, sir. Late June, early July, just after midsummer, sir, when the young men go off." I had never heard of this phenomenon. Why had not Oxborough mentioned it? Was that why he and the housekeeper and the local constable had all exhibited such a lack of concern at Chester's unexplained disappearance? Go off? Go off where? She frowned and smiled at once, amused, I suppose, at my ignorance. Why all sorts of places, sir. The mood comes over them, they just pick up their things and go. Some to the Thames, Ipswich or Bury generally. Some even head for London. Don't hear much of those ones after. Her mouth quirked as if she had tasted something bitter, and I guessed her sweetheart may have been one of the country moths lost to the capital's entrancing flame. And what of the others? I asked, stifling the urgency in my tone so as not to alarm her. What could it portend, this queer rural exodus? What had it to do with Chester? Why, she said softly, blue eyes wide and guileless. Nobody knows, sir. I all but scoffed aloud. In this modern world of telegraphs and railways and photography, with a police station in every town, how could a phalanx of stray youths hope to escape detection, whether dead or alive? They must not wish to be found, then, I suggested. Well, she said briskly, evidently tiring of the topic, whether they wish it or no, 'tis the last anyone sees of them, the ones what don't come back. She flinched as an impatient gesture from the bar recalled her to her duties and implored me with her eyes. "I'm sorry, sir. I must get back." I fumbled a shilling from my pocket and held it up before her. "One question more, my dear. Indulge me?" She nodded, relaxing at the glimpse of silver. "And this is always around midsummer? Every year?" "Aye. Always a few weeks before harvest time. It's a fearful nuisance to the farmers to bring in hands from Norfolk." "What? It only happens in this county, then?" A hunted look crept into her face. "I never thought to wonder, sir. I fancy maybe it is a local difficulty. I never heard of it elsewhere, anyhow." I had heard more than enough to set my brain ticking like an overwound watch. I gave her the shilling, with my grateful thanks, and watched her half flee to the safety of the bar. It was quite plain that she was as baffled by our exchange as I was, if for entirely opposite reasons. I drained my coffee, tucked away Chester's letter, and left payment on the table, weighing down the folded map with a coin. This mystery only deepened, and, like the South Sea diver, I must plunge into it still further and faster if I hope to rise again.